Recordings have been started.
Okay, thank you everyone. Welcome. This is Jeff Newman. I'm one of the co-chairs, along with Avery Doria, of the subsequent procedures policy development process, dealing with the procedures for the introduction of new GTLDs. And I wanted to welcome everyone to this first webinar. There'll be a second webinar that will be a little bit later on today for those in the West Coast and for the Asia Pacific, so that they could, so everyone has access to these presentations. There have been over 180 RSVPs for these calls, so it seems to have generated a good amount of interest. And before I go on to the next couple of slides, I just wanted to clarify that on this webinar, we are, and in the face-to-face sessions that will happen at ICANN 59, we are going to be dealing with geographic names at the top level. So we know that there may be some issues that a number of people may still have with geographic terms at the second level, but those, although those will be addressed at some point in the future, those will not be the subject of this webinar or, in fact, the face-to-face sessions that will happen at ICANN 59 in Johannesburg. So just to move on, I'll move on to the next slide, that this is really our agenda for today, that I will give a brief introduction into the topic of the geographic names issues. And but most of our time will be really spent with presentations from a number of individuals and groups that have expressed in the past certain aspects or certain viewpoints on geographic terms at the top level. And after each of those presentations, we will then go into a Q&A session. And I'll be going over some of the ground rules as to how to get questions submitted in a couple of slides. So just moving on, I'll move on to the next one here. As I note that I have control over the slides, I'm not sure if it's unsynced, but I have control over here. So the purpose of this webinar is really to just coordinate different efforts that are going on separately, each of them focusing on different aspects of the geographic names at the top level issues. And so, for example, there's an effort underway right now that has just finished its initial comment period. That's a cross-community working group on the use of country and territory names at the top level. There's also a separate effort going on right now with geographic names in the Governmental Advisory Committee. There's a subgroup that's created just to deal with these types of geographic issues. And, of course, there are issues that are being dealt with in the GNSO's policy development process on subsequent procedures. This is clearly a topic that needs to be addressed prior to the introduction of new GTLDs. Before we go on anymore, I noticed that the slides are moving relatively quickly. Each of the presenters have access to moving the slides, so I would ask that the presenters not actually move the slides and let whoever's speaking at that point in time control the slides. So for now, that's me, and so I would ask that none of the presenters please move the slides. I will go back to the slide that we're on. This is one of those Adobe Connect issues that we sometimes have where there's multiple presenters. I'm just trying to move up slides here. Someone seems to be also trying to fight me on this one. So I'm actually going to go to my own copy of the slides while perhaps ICANN staff, if you can work on the slides. So a number of these issues, just for background, began out of the IDN working group that was created in 2007, which really was the first one to recognize that a group, a cross-community group, needed to be set up to handle geographic terms at the top level. And shortly thereafter, this was a topic that was addressed by the Governmental Advisory Committee in 2007 when it, in its communique, drafted several principles. And one of those recommendations from the GAC was number 2.2, which said that ICANN should avoid country, territory, or place names and country, territory, or regional language or people descriptions unless in agreement with the relevant governments or public authorities. Again, in 2000, or later on that year, 2007, there was a reserve names working group that was created by the generic name supporting organization to look at the topic of reserve names, including geographic names. Their recommendation to the GENASO Council, which was ultimately adopted and sent to the board, states that the proposed challenge mechanisms currently being proposed in the draft new GTLD process would allow for national or local governments to initiate a challenge. Therefore, no additional protection mechanisms are needed. So the GNSO essentially recommended that there would be no geographic reserve names, but only a challenge mechanism. After that time period and before the applicant guidebook was created, there was language that was included from the reserve names working group in the initial drafts of the applicant guidebook. That went through, as many of you know, a number of revisions and ultimately culminated in 2012, early 2012, with the final applicant guidebook, which incorporated a recommendation that said that strings must not be a reserved word. And the way that was interpreted was that, in terms of geographic terms, was that two characters should be reserved at the top level for only CCTLDs, and that ultimately certain country names and territory names that were included in very specific lists, ISO lists in some occasions, and a couple of other lists that were referenced in the guidebook, those were specifically reserved from being applied for in the 2012 round. Since then, the GNSO has not developed any additional recommendations, but what we had happen in 2012 was that there were 66 self-identified geographic names that were applied for pursuant to that section in the applicant guidebook. And an additional, those geographic names were required to go through a panel, and six of those names that were self-identified as geographic did not actually fit the geographic names criteria, and those are listed in the slides. Three of the applications did not self-identify, but actually did meet the applicant guidebook criteria, and those were Tata, Bar, and Tui. And of the 63 remaining, 56 of them had acceptable documentation of support or non-objection from the relevant government authority, and of those, 54 have so far been delegated. Now, there were additional strings that were the subject of one or more GAC early warnings, and those strings are listed in the slide on the 2012 round. Those were not contained within the specific lists in the applicant guidebook. However, many of them were either subject to GAC advice or were terms that were worked out with relevant governmental authorities as to how to proceed. So in moving just to the next steps, what we hope to do with this webinar and with the face-to-face sessions really is to share information, to collaborate, such that we can then publish these transcripts and translations in the UN languages and have supplemental materials provided by the presenters to the extent that there are questions, and then announce further details about the format of the ICANN 59 sessions, including the structure of those sessions, as well as the anticipated outcomes. Just a quick overview of the ground rules. Really, I ask that everyone be mindful of the ICANN standards of behavior, which are listed at that link. We will try to address questions during the Q&A portion at the end of the webinar, recognizing that we will likely not have enough time to address all of the questions. We will then address those questions to each of the speakers to see if they would like an opportunity to present written responses and then publish those responses. And the way we're going to ask that questions be presented is by typing into the chat using the open parentheses question and then the closed parentheses so that we know and can track what questions you want to present to the presenters. Of course, we encourage you to use the chat function on Adobe to give us your thoughts and perceptions. We're really asking for mostly clarifying questions at this point in time. We recognize that people have very different viewpoints. So although you will have plenty of time during the face-to-face sessions and between now and then to present those, what we're really trying to collect now are clarifying questions. So with that, we have a great slate of speakers, as you can see in the right-hand side of Adobe. And I want to not waste any more time and get on to those speakers. So I will ask if Heather Forrest is on the line, which I know she is, to get started on the first presentation.
Thanks, Jeff, very much. This is Heather. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Fantastic. Natalie, for the purposes of, I know Jeff had trouble with the slides, is it easier for you if I just let you run the slides? I only have three, so, or would you rather I do it?
Hi, Heather, this is Emily. We're going to actually control the slides for all of the presenters, I think, at this point, just to keep things simpler. So just let us know when you're ready to turn them.
Good. That probably seems like a good idea. So thank you very much, Jeff, for the introduction and the background material, and thank you to everyone for attending the call. I think this is a marvelous opportunity. In my mind, a bit tragic that it's coming now and not in 2007 or even sooner, but the phrase better late than never comes to mind. I am not here to present a position in the sense of a suggestion of what we do. I suppose I'm here to offer some background and context. And before I do that, perhaps I'll give a 30-second context to the context. So in 2006, I was a practicing lawyer in London and watching the policy development process gearing up towards new GTLDs, and I was finding it interesting that comments that were made that would ultimately form policy were based on assumptions in relation to geographic names, or at least what I suspected were assumptions. There was no demonstrated analysis of the legal aspect of positions that were stated then in relation to geographic names. And I actually left private legal practice to undertake a doctoral thesis on this question. So what you are seeing today is a summary of my doctoral thesis, which was completed in Switzerland. And as you might imagine, it's rather difficult to summarize a 500-page thesis in three slides, but I'm going to gamely try and do that. In order to facilitate that process, I have provided a background document, which, again, is quite high level. It's certainly no replacement for the body of my research. But I hope that it would be much more helpful in this context. I've written it for non-lawyers, so the lawyers may find it perhaps lacking. But I have written it for the ICANN context as opposed to the precisely legal context. So with that, may I ask, Emily, that you turn to the second slide for me, please? In my mind, there are several questions to be asked, and I think the primary question that needs to be asked is whether governments have what we call in the law sovereign rights in geographic names. Sovereign rights is a pretty difficult concept to define. It's a concept from international law, and it's really a concept that has to do with whether a country is treated as a country by other countries, if you like, and what that country can do within and without of its own borders. What I found on this was that there really isn't any connection in international law between sovereignty and country names. In other words, a country does not have to have a name to be considered a sovereign country, and being a sovereign entity, being a sovereign country, doesn't give it any rights in relation to names. There are some provisions within international law that talk about sovereign rights in relation to symbols, but names are not mentioned there. And what I would say to that, let's say perhaps the suggestion would be an easy solution is to add names to those provisions that that deal with sovereign rights in international law. And my answer to that is those provisions are really very limited. And even if country names were added to those provisions of international law, it would really only deal with their use as trademarks, and it wouldn't actually do anything in relation to domain names or TLD strings. So the answer that I have reached in after quite extensive several years of analysis on the question of whether governments have rights, have sovereign rights in geographic names, the answer is no under international law. Next slide, please, Emily. So I suppose having asked, do governments have these rights in specific kind of rights, sovereign rights in geographic names, the next question logically means to be, do other people have rights in geographic names under international law? I'm dealing strictly with international law. And the answer to that question is yes. It's actually a fairly easy question to answer in a sense that international trademark law does not stop folks from having trademarks that are comprised of geographic names. Some countries choose to do that, but they're not required to do that. And in fact, very many countries allow governments and others, companies, individuals, to have rights in geographic names. In some countries, and this would be a matter of their domestic law, the law within that country, there's also recognition of something we call geographical indications, which has to do with the name of a product. And it's specifically referring to its origin in a particular place. The challenge with that is that protection is actually only available in 28 of the countries of the world, whereas trademark protection is much more widespread and is available in most countries of the world. So the answer is yes, there are others who have rights in geographic names. So what does that mean, let's say, for the DNS? And if I go to my final slide, I'll wind up. While that's on its way, there we go. Thank you, Emily. So what that means, to the extent that we have others with rights in geographic names, what that means is it's simply not possible. It's not logical. It's not correct to say that governments are the only parties with rights in geographic names. And what that means is we simply can't, at least in international law, justify any sort of exclusive reservation or priority, because if governments aren't the only folks who can use these names, then that means we're possibly trampling on the rights of others to the extent that we give them exclusively to government. And we also need to be very careful of refusals. We can't simply have policy that allows refusal of a geographic name simply because whoever has asked to use it is not a government. And likewise, the same conclusion applies for a geographical indication holder, someone who has use of the names of these products. I'm conscious that I started 3 minutes late, so I'm ending 3 minutes late, but I am on time. I will wind up there. I apologize that I'm not able to join you for the Q&A at the end because of the time zone. It's very late here in Tasmania. But I'd be very happy. I know that the folks running the webinar will take questions, and I will follow up with those by writing. So thank you very much, Jeff. Back to you.
Next, we have Jorge Cancio from Switzerland. So, Jorge, if you are on, if you could please start.
Hello. Did you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you, Jorge.
Hello, Jeff, and hello, everybody. Just as context for my intervention here, first, would need to say that I'm jumping in for the chair of the GAC Working Group on the Protection of Geographic Names in the new GTL LEAF, which is Ms. Olga Cavalli from Argentina. She asked me a couple of days ago to jump in, so I'm doing this a bit on an improvised basis, but I'll do my best. As a matter of context, I can also say that the presentation you are seeing has been agreed per email by the GAC Working Group, but that, as you will see, the GAC Working Group and the GAC plenary for sure is still a long way from having a consensus position on this topic. Next slide, please. Well, the basis or the start of the work of this working group began at the Durban meeting in 2013, it started also focusing almost all the time during the last 2 years at least on those geographic names which are not covered by the applicant guidebook rules of 2012. So what this presentation will be about is about those terms with geographic significance which are not under the rules of AGB of 2012, which are, for instance, the country and territory names or the capital city names or city names, which are all covered by the AGB of 2012. But as also Jeff mentioned before, excuse me, the 2012 round showed that there were a number of applications which had a string which could have a geographic meaning, which resulted to be somewhat problematic. Next slide. Well, the terms of reference of the GAC Working Group are here. If you have interest, you can look at them in more detail, but I think that it's more interesting to go to the next slide. And this is really what has been the heart of the discussion within the GAC Working Group, is how to deal with those strings that were not covered by the 2012 AGB, but nevertheless showed to be problematic. And on page 7 of the background paper, which has been developed by the co-chairs of the GMSL PDP, a working group on subsequent procedures. There is a list of those problematic strains. I think there were 18 at least during the 2012 round, which could qualify as such strains with a geographic meaning, which didn't fit into the categories of the African Guidebook of 2012. And in many of those strains, we ended up with some problems, and some of them are still pending. So the focus of the GAC working group was to discuss a future agreed framework for terms with geographic significance falling beyond the rules of the 2012 African Guidebook. In Copenhagen, we had a full discussion of a proposal that was presented in September 2016, and the GAC working group, as I said before, didn't reach any consensus, but it is going to follow up with discussion and hopefully to make an input to the wider community on this topic. To sum up a little bit this proposal, which is being discussed in the GAC, I could say that it's in addition to the African Guidebook rules of 2012, it provides for a due diligence search obligation for the applicant who would need to look into whether the string they are applying to has a geographic significance. For this to be made more easier, one of the ideas was to create a repository of terms with geographic significance to be maintained by ICANN, and which would be fed by relevant international lists, and also by community feedback, also the inclusion of terms by relevant governments. This list would include also the contact details of those authorities and a brief justification of the claim they have on the relevant term. Another principle which was included in that draft proposal is that there is a public consultation requirement, that there is also an opportunity to raise any concerns about any such strings, a contact obligation in case of a match or a confusingly similar name. The applicant would get in touch with the relevant government or public authority, and a non-objection requirement by that government or authority, with the special provision that in case that the applicant wasn't agreeing with that position, with a negative position from the government, there would be a dispute resolution process established by ICANN before an independent panel, which would decide according to ICANN bylaws and mission and so on and so forth. Next slide, and excuse me if I'm being slower, but as a non-native speaker, this is a bit more difficult, I guess, than for others. This slide really summarizes the divergent views within the GAC working group on the draft proposal. Those divergent views center around the instrument of the repository. There are some more in favor, some against, so you can look into the details of this. And last slide, if if you are interested in following the work of the working group. These are open sessions, and I guess that the chairwoman of the working group would be more than happy to have an active participation also from people which don't belong to the GAC. Thank you.
Thanks, Jorge. This is Jeff Newman again. Thanks for stepping in and presenting on behalf of Olga Cavalli. I know she's traveling today, and I think she will be able to present for the second webinar. So thanks for stepping in. The next speaker we have is Alexander Schubert. So I'm going to throw it over to Alexander.
Yeah, hi. This is Alexander, co-founder of .Berlin and founder of a company that will apply for .USA in the next round. My presentation is rather short, so I'm making some time up. It's a subsegment of the rather wide field of geographic names. I'm talking about the treatment of country and territory names and ISO 3166 alpha 3 codes. If you could move to the second slide. So I'm looking into a path to make country and territory names and alpha 3 codes eligible as TLDs. As you have heard in the first presentation of Heather, where she explained that there is kind of an absence of rights for governments into those names. Naturally, the governments had been a little bit confused about what is going to happen with their names, because even if they maybe don't have rights into their names, there's still the wish to protect them. So, as a result, in the 2012 application round, these names had been simply made ineligible. So you couldn't even apply for them. And I'm afraid it will stay like that if we don't find some path forward which would be seen as acceptable by the government. So what I propose is that there was provision in the applicant guidebook in 2012, the 2.2.1.4.1, that simply said, okay, those you cannot apply for a country name or a three-letter code for a country. So that entire provision should simply be deleted from the future applicant guidebook. But naturally, it has to be replaced with something so that governments can fulfill their duty to make sure that there is no unfair or dishonest use, as Heather explained. So they, of course, want to see who's going to apply for those names, what are they going to do with those names, how can we be sure that they're treating our country name nice and are not going to abuse it or act as if it would be by the government, but it is not. So there is already in the applicant guidebook another provision, the 2.2.1.4.2, and in paragraph 3, it already grants protections to governments in regard for example, city names. So the government has to issue a letter of non-objection if you want to apply for a city like .Berlin. That paragraph 3 could be simply amended so that it includes the country and territory names and the 3166 alpha 3 country codes. They're currently not included because they were not eligible for application, so they could be listed there. And as a result, if someone wanted to apply for .Spain, for example, they would have to go to the Spanish government and present their plan, how they want to do it and who they are, and the Spanish government could make an assessment whether they would trust that group and their policies, and then they give a letter of non-objection or not. I agree with Heather that it should not be that the Spanish government says, well, it's our name, Spain, and we will give it to no one. they would probably have to explain why they are not issuing a letter of non-objection. And additionally, there had been a number of GUT members who said that they would rather not rely on their own government because they are not really trusting their government. They would like themselves to be presented with such an application and issue a letter of non-objection. So that could be another provision that the relevant GUT member had to issue a letter of non-objection. That would be an option. And then if you talk to CCTLD managers, they are not really keen on competition, and they don't like the idea that there is someone running a three-letter code as a TOD, because they think it's kind of like a GTOD as a CCTOD with three letters. So there could be the option that also the relevant CCTOD manager would have to issue a letter of non-objection. So he's presented with the plan, and he makes sure that there is no conflict with his CCTOD. The third slide, next slide. So if we look at the two-letter labels, because it seems that the CCTOD managers are some of those who are really blocking three-letter codes as TODs. John Postel, in his 1994 RFC 1591, had a clear vision of how CCTODs and GTODs look like. And I think that the entire two-character label namespace should stay reserved for the CCTODs. So even if there are a few labels like .AA or .ZZ that can never be assigned to a country because they're publicly reserved, it's a little bit the same like with the IP range 192, 168, and so on and so forth. No one can use that in the internet. It would not root. It would stay within your own net. So even those labels like .AA, which would fit to American Airlines, which have AA.com, I think it should still stay reserved for the CCNSO. And the same with mixed kind of numeric and other characters like M3 or F1. Because if there would be two-letter codes assigned as a GTOD, we would kind of harm the order. So GTODs should have three or more letters, and everything that is two letters should stay a CCTOD. And this shouldn't be a one-way. It should be the same way the other around. So if something has more than two characters, it should be a GTOD and not a CCTOD. I'm finished.
Thanks, Alexander, and thanks for presenting a proposal. I think there may be a couple other proposals that are presented during these sessions, along with the one that was presented by Jorge, and so these are going to be very helpful going into the sessions at ICANN 59. Next, we have Flip Patian from Marx. Flip, if you can hear me, we're ready for you to get started.
Thank you, Jeff. Do you hear me well?
Great. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff, and ICANN and the ICANN community for this opportunity for Marx. I'm indeed speaking today on behalf of Marx, which is the European Association representing brand owners' interests. Marx unites European and international brand owners across all product sectors. It addresses issues associated with the use, protection, and value of IP rights, as these are vital to innovation, growth, and job creation. Marx membership crosses all industry lines, and it includes brand owners and trademark professionals in more than 80 countries. Marx's position on the protection of geographic names in the new GTLD process is actually as follows. We have consulted widely amongst our members, and nearly 4 years ago, we wrote to the chairman of the board of ICANN on the subject of the protection of geographic terms. And our position hasn't changed over the years. Please, Emily, yes, move to this slide. Thank you. There are currently thousands of brands registered in Europe which share geographic or cultural meanings. Examples are on this slide here. You will probably recognize many of them. Actually, it's the previous slide. They include well-known brands in the fields of communications like Nokia, a town in Finland, beverages like Amsterdam, a city in the Netherlands, cosmetics, Avon, county and the river in the United Kingdom, pharmaceuticals, Milan, a city in Italy, and insurance even, Zurich, a city in Switzerland. And there are many more. These brands are established trademark rights that have been obtained lawfully by trademark owners in numerous nation states. Please move to the next slide, Emily. Over the years, ICANN's governmental advisory committee has consistently supported lawful IP rights protection mechanisms in the new GTLD program, and Marx strongly appreciates that support. When it comes to the use of names which may have a geographic meaning as a top-level domain, however, whilst Marx recognizes that this can be a sensitive subject for some governments, it's important that those governments act in accordance with the international treaties to which they are signatories and respect globally recognized legal principles. Those international treaties, such as the Paris Convention and TRIPS Agreement, they grant long-standing rights to trademark owners to be able to use and register terms which, in another context, might be considered geographic. They impose jurisdictional limits on any national interests in such names. Even in the case of a conflict between an existing trademark right and claimed national interest in such term, international jurisprudence, international case law informs us, it learns us that such terms may coexist, but not to the detriment of trademark owners' rights. Please move to the next slide, Emily. It follows from this internationally accepted legal foundation that nation states should not act through ICANN to arbitrarily restrict trademark owners' rights to make lawful use of their trademarks when international agreements to which they are signatories would not allow such restriction. Current and future new GT